providing small raises despite having a down year. Our company revenue is down 1% this year, the first time in 17 years we didn't grow, he said. We choose to do zero layoffs and gave small raises, crushing our profit.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's foreign minister says the European signatories to the Iran nuclear deal have the last chance to save the international accord. The UN envoy to the Middle East slams Israel's settlement activities as a flagrant violation of international law. And the U.S. Congress passes a massive coronavirus aid package aimed at throwing a lifeline to the country's pandemic-battered economy. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisumi Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran's foreign minister says the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal have gravely breached their commitments under the accord. Mohammad Javad Zarif made these criticisms in a tweet following a virtual meeting with foreign ministers of the remaining signatories to the deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Zarif said Britain, France, and Germany should share the blame with the U.S. for what he called irreparable harm to Iranians. He added that the trio have a last chance to save the pact, which he reiterated was not renegotiable. During the Monday meeting, the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov demanded Washington return to the deal without any preconditions, a call that was also echoed by China's top diplomat.
The United States should return to the Iran nuclear deal unconditionally as soon as possible. It should also lift the sanctions against Iran, third-party entities, as well as individuals. And on this basis, Iran should fully resume its nuclear commitments.
At the end of the meeting, all of the remaining parties to the JCPOA issued a statement reiterating their deep regret over the U.S.'s unilateral withdrawal from the deal. They also once again called for preserving the agreement. They said UN Security Council Resolution 2231 that endorsed the accord remains in full force. Iran's oil minister Bijan Zangane has described Russia as a strategic partner, saying both Tehran and Moscow share close views within the OPEC Plus alliance. Zangane made the remarks after a meeting with the Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak in Moscow. He said that the Iran-Russia partnership will not, quote, change with the warm and calm atmosphere in the international arena. OPEC Plus, a wider group of oil-producing and exporting countries, including Russia, decided earlier this month to increase output to 500,000 barrels a day. Russia has said that it would push a further increase of 500,000 barrels in OPEC Plus and the meeting that was scheduled for January the 4th. This, as several OPEC members have insisted on producing production cuts to diminish the demands due to the diminishing demand because of the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. Navy says one of its nuclear submarines has crossed the Strait of Hormuz, a move that would increase tensions in the region. The U.S. Navy, that usually does not disclose the presence of its submarines, gave a full statement of their capabilities. 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Army also sent two B-2 bombers capable of carrying nuclear warheads, which flew over the Persian Gulf region. Both cases have been highly publicized. The U.S. has increased its military maneuvers in the region. As the anniversary of the assassination of Iranian General Qasem Soleimani is approaching, Washington fears that Iran might once again strike U.S. forces in the region in retaliation for Soleimani's assassination. Head of the U.S. forces in the Middle East told journalists on Sunday that Washington is prepared to react if Iran attacks them. The U.S. Special Envoy for the Middle East says Israel's settlement activity is a flagrant violation of the world body's resolutions and international law, and it must cease immediately. Addressing the U.N. Security Council, Nikolai Maldonov says that settlements entrench the Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands. He also expressed deep concern over the continued demolition and seizure of Palestinian properties at the hands of Israeli troops. The Israeli regime, with the green light from the United States and amid the silence of most Arab countries, has driven up its illegal settlement activities in recent years. The Israeli demolition of Palestinian homes as a collective punishment has been denounced repeatedly by rights organizations. Israeli forces have fatally shot a Palestinian teenager in the old city of occupied Jerusalem al-Quds. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandel, joined us with the latest on this incident.
Israeli forces shot dead a Palestinian teenager in the city of Jerusalem al-Quds, mainly at one of the gates of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, namely Bab Hukta or Hukta Gate. The Israeli forces claimed that this Palestinian had a Carlotarp submachine gun, and he tried to open fire at police station there. However, the Israeli forces there immediately opened fire and killed him at the spot. All the area there was completely sealed off. The Israelis attacked Palestinian worshippers inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound, and then it was revealed that another Palestinian was arrested by the Israeli forces later. The Israeli military revealed that 17-year-old Palestinian from the city, from the town of Qabatia, northern the occupied West Bank, and not from Jerusalem. Al-Quds.
The Yemeni Scholars Association has held a press conference to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. The scholars also called any normalization a stab in the back of the Palestinian cause. Our correspondent in the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, has more.
Yemeni scholars came together in the capital, Sana'a, to condemn some Arab states for normalizing ties with the Israeli regime. They said that with signing normalization deals with Israel, these states have betrayed the Palestinians.
We've announced the continuous processes of normalization of ties with the Zionist entity. We are here to warn other Arab states not to follow the same path. Any normalization deal amounts to the betrayal of the blood of the martyrs who sacrificed their lives to protect the occupied lands against Israeli aggression.
Morocco has been the last Arab state to normalize ties with Israel after Bahrain, the UAE, and Sudan over the past months.
The scholars of Yemen reiterate their opposition to any recognition of the Zionist enemy. We believe that it amounts to betrayal of the Muslim values. This will pave the way for further aggression against the Palestinians.
The normalization deals have already sparked outrage among the public in the Muslim world, with a pro-Palestine sentiment runs deep. Meanwhile, Palestinians from all political factions have been unanimous in their condemnation of the normalization deals. They seek an independent state in the West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip with the East Jerusalem Al-Quds as its capital. So the normalization, they say, serves as betrayal of their cause.
Yemeni scholars voiced their support for the Palestinians, warning Arab world to adopt a united stance against Israeli aggression. They say the normalization deals will only embolden Israel to press ahead with its oppressive policies against the Palestinians. Abdul Latif Al-Washalib, Sana'a.
Outgoing U.S. Attorney General William Barr refuses to appoint a special counsel to investigate President-elect Joe Biden's son and the November 3rd presidential election.
Well, if I thought a special counsel at this stage was the right tool and was appropriate, I would name one, but I haven't. And to this point, I have not seen a reason to appoint a special counsel, and I have no plan to do so before I leave.
Barr added that he believes the investigation on Hunter Biden's tax affairs is being handled responsibly and professionally within the Justice Department. The president-elect's son disclosed earlier this month that the attorney's office in Delaware is looking into his tax affairs. Barr, who is set to leave office this week, also said that he would not appoint any special counsel to investigate President Donald Trump's voter fraud allegations. The Attorney General's successor has declined to say if he would appoint a special counsel to investigate these two issues. The U.S. Senator says dozens of email accounts at the Treasury Department have been hacked in a recent wide-ranging cyber attack on government agencies. Ron Wyden says the hackers broke into the systems and they used the department's highest-ranking officials in what appears to be a significant operation. The Democrat says that the breach seems to involve the theft of encryption keys from government servers. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has accused Russia of carrying out these attacks. That is while President Donald Trump has tried to minimize the impact of the attack. Contradicting Pompeo and other officials, Trump has pointed the finger at China. Both Russia and China have denied any involvement. The U.S. Congress has approved a $900 billion coronavirus relief package after months of political wrangling. The Senate approved the bill hours after it was passed by the House of Representatives. President Donald Trump is expected to sign it into law. The package includes payments for millions of Americans. It also includes jobless programs and supports businesses battered by the pandemic. Democrats and Republicans were for months in a dispute over the package, mainly on how much money they should be spent. The U.S. has the world's largest coronavirus outbreak. Its total confirmed cases are above 18 million, with over 319,000 deaths so far. The virus has surged in recent months, threatening a tentative economic recovery. Now, let's talk to David Barkin, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the Metropolitan Autonomous University. If you could please tell us more about the significance of this decision and the different aspects of it.
Yes, it's good that they made a deal, but the deal is a really terrible deal for most American people. It involves a much smaller amount of money and a smaller safety net for the people, for the most vulnerable people in the United States. It is once again a tribute to the American Congress's cynicism by giving a gigantic amount of money to airlines and no relief at all to the restaurant industry. It involves a tremendous decline in the amount of money that will be available for American workers as compared to the previous aid bill. And even more terribly, it reinforces the U.S., the United States' isolationism by not allowing the International Monetary Fund to issue special drawing rights to help aid the extraordinary increase in hunger and joblessness in the third world. This is a bill that is meant to be a political victory for a very centrist group of people, and they had to pay a very, very large price to the corporate sector of the United States. And once again, it shows the United States' niggardliness, its extraordinary unwillingness to provide any help to the rest of the world.
Thank you very much, Mr. David Barkin, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the Metropolitan Autonomous University. Moving on, a new variant of the COVID-19 virus has caused major concern across Europe, forcing the British government to scrap the five-day Christmas break and prompting European countries to bar Britons trying to fly out at the last minute. Bianca Rahimi has more.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and eastern England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe, a step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster, and there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal. Brexit negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The limelight.
A new report from prison abolition group Worth Rises has exposed the extent to which corporate America profits from the desperation of the incarcerated. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod Ryder. This article is published under the heading New Report Details the shocking growth of the prison exploitation across the United States of America. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. A new report from prison abolition group Worth Rises has exposed the extent to which corporate America profits from the desperation of the incarcerated. The 132-page study entitled The Prison Industry, How It Started, How It Works, How It Harms, blows the lid off the scandalous business practices organizations involved in what has become known as the prison industrial complex, employed to reap billions in annual profits. The prison industry is in our society, and yet we pay so little attention to it, and we know so little about it. This report is really hoping to unveil the prison industry, the government, and corporate actors who are exploiting the fact that they have been in the shadows. Bianca Tylek, Worth Rises founder and executive director, told Mint Press News. In economics, a captive market is a situation where consumers face a severely limited number of suppliers, meaning their only choice is to purchase what is available, usually at much higher price, or make no purchase at all. Most people resent and feel exploited by the higher prices in captive market situations like stadiums, movie theaters, and airports, but prisons take captive markets to a whole new level. Being incarcerated is expensive, with inmates forced to pay for extra food and many things most would consider basic necessities such as toothpaste and phone calls. Often just being sent to a correctional facility incurs a $100 processing fee prisoners must pay, while visitors are often charged background check fees as well. Prisoners' friends and families transfer $1.8 billion into correctional facilities every year. Faced with no other choices, they are forced to accept money transfer fees up to an outrageous 45%. Financial corporations like JPay and JP Morgan Chase partner with correctional facilities in order to ensure the best deal for them and the worst deal for the prisoners. As the report notes, the industry was built on a profit-sharing model between financial services corporations and correctional agencies, the cost of which is layered onto money transfer fees and billed to families. After years of corporate grooming, some agencies now explicitly award contractors to bidder offering the highest kickback percentage. As a result, not only are contracts often awarded to the most expensive service provider, but correctional administrators are also incentivized to limit cheaper or free alternatives from which they do not profit. U.S. prisoners are often forced to use special cards for purchases, many of which charge fees as high as $2.95 per transaction, 95 cents dollars for declined transactions, and a weekly service fee of $2.50. And on the outside, J.P. Morgan Chase charges a $10 fee to withdraw money from the card at an ATM. Phone calls are often far from free. The correctional telecom market is worth $1.4 billion annually, with charges of upwards of $1 per minute. Little wonder, then, that one in three prisoners go into debt trying to stay in contact with their loved ones. While prisoners are given enough food to keep them alive, it is of notoriously low quality, with food poisoning more than six times more likely to occur in jails and prisons than average, the report notes. Nationally, correctional facilities spend just $2.30 per person per day on food, a number lower than the average daily commissary spend per inmate. That is about $2.59. There is no doubt that in many cases, people spend a lot more on commissary than the system spends to feed them. That you can see time and time again. The state tries to spend as little as it possibly can get away with the while upcharging for all of the products that people can purchase in commissary, Talik told me in Press News. Any wages earned while incarcerated are unlikely to greatly outweigh expenditures. Average hourly wages for workers in facility support jobs range between $0 and $0.63, with five states not paying workers anything. Prisons are one of the last great centers of American manufacturing, making everything from military equipment to mattresses to 3 million face masks. 40% of California's firefighters are prisoners, earning only a few dollars per day to risk their lives. The state's response to this summer's wildfires was hampered by the COVID-19 outbreak among its prisons, meaning large parts of its fire response teams were in isolation. Until recently, former prisoners were effectively barred from applying to become firefighters. With almost 2.3 million people locked up across a sprawling network of over 7,000 facilities, the United States has by far the highest incarceration rate in the world, locking its citizens up at over 10 minutes, the rate of European countries like Denmark or Sweden, and over 17 times than that of Japan. Wolf Rice's report notes that $4.6 billion is spent in the U.S. every year on the construction of new facilities. Nearly 600 prisons have been built on or in close proximity to contaminated toxic land, leading to injury, illness, birth defects, and death. And for-profit private prisons are another growing phenomenon in America's incarceration system. Since 2000, the number of people incarcerated in private prisons has increased by 39.3%, compared to an overall rise of 7.8%. Their ubiquity has become so unremarkable that earlier this year, a private prison simulator game went viral, becoming the number one game in Apple's App Store. During the tutorial, at the start of the game, a baton-wielding guard instructs players, telling them that the state pays us good money to manage the lowlifes they send your way. It's perfect business, he says, as he shows you how to send inmates to solitary confinement, something that is near universally described as torture. The game was received extremely positively, with few negative comments focusing on annoying ads and in-app purchases, not the game's concept. The Wars Rises report notes that American solitary cells are so small that 19 of them could fit into an average one-bedroom apartment. For many, a change in government from Republican to Democrat represents an opportunity for a new start. On incarceration, however, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been plagued by their close ties to the prison industrial complex. For years, Biden touted his involvement in now infamous 1994 crime bill, which critics say helped supercharge mass incarceration nationwide. Harris, meanwhile, a former prosecutor and district attorney, used to describe herself as California's top cop and pursued harsh sentences for relatively minor drug offenses, including ones that she herself admits she committed in her youth. Nevertheless, public sentiment towards the issue of mass incarceration is beginning to change.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
European News Bulletin.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. My name is Saeed Pourreza. Our top story: a new variant of the COVID-19 virus has caused major concern across Europe, forcing the British government to scrap the 5-day Christmas break and prompting European countries to bar Britons trying to get away at the last minute. Initially, France banned all freight from the UK as well, but amid fears of food shortages, the French government says it'll establish a protocol to ensure movement from the UK can resume. Bianca Rahimi has our report.
The news was delivered Saturday that the southeast and east of England, including the capital London, were descending into Tier 4 COVID-19 restrictions. This was sparked by the discovery of a new variant of the virus that is up to 70% more transmittable.
Given the early evidence we have on this new variant of the virus, the potential risk it poses, it is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned. In England, those living in Tier 4 areas should not mix with anyone outside their own household at Christmas, though support bubbles will remain in place for those at particular risk of loneliness or isolation.
After the announcement, chaos ensued as people scrambled to leave ahead of the midnight deadline. People bundled up presents and essentials and set out hoping to save their Christmas plans after England's Chief Medical Officer Chris Whitty suggested they unpack.
I want to put some numbers out there because I think that helps to explain why I'm going to give the answer that I'm going to give. But my short answer would be, please unpack it at this stage.
Officials say that the ban on Tier 4 Christmas visits is unenforceable. And to make things worse, hundreds of flights were cancelled after the UK's closest allies cut transport with it due to fears about the new COVID-19 strain. The decision meant closing off the UK's most important artery with mainland Europe, a step British Transport Minister Grant Shapps said was surprising, especially as, according to him, the new strain is already in continental Europe.
We tend to be more aware of the variants faster. And there have been thousands of variants of coronavirus. It's just that the particular one that we've seen in Kent and London, the thing which has led to the Tier 4 lockdown, is a particularly virulent variant of the virus. So it means that it spreads more easily. We've detected that first, but we know already that the cases have been found in continental Europe and other countries.
The chaos hit just days before the United Kingdom was due to exit the EU's orbit with or without a trade deal. Brexit negotiators Michel Barnier and Lord Frost met in Brussels Sunday, but yet again, an agreement was not reached. In view of the situation, Brexit negotiations could be extended. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Following weeks of intensive talks, the head of the EU's Brexit group, David McAllister, has announced there was still no clarity on whether the EU and UK would reach a Brexit trade agreement. EU chief negotiator Michel Barnier and his UK counterpart David Frost met in Brussels Sunday but didn't find agreement. With 10 days to go before the UK formally leaves the EU, key issues around trade competition and fishing remain unresolved. At the same time, Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has urged the UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson to seek an extension to the Brexit transition period in light of new restrictions brought on by Britain's COVID crisis. All right, let's talk about those two stories with Chris Bambury. He's an author and political commentator joining me now. Thanks for coming onto the show. Before we get to Brexit negotiations, I want to get your opinion, your reaction on the screeching U-turn by the Prime Minister on Saturday on Christmas rules.
I think it was a chaotic reversal by Boris Johnson. And I say that because it's become clear that they were aware of this new variant of COVID-19 for a considerable period of time, and that the cases were rising. You could read that in the daily briefings on what's happening in London and the South East. And therefore, I think it should have happened much earlier, allowing people not to have to rip up their Christmas plans, which is what's happened in the final days of this most important holiday of the year, and causing a lot of bitterness. So I think this is just once again a sign of the incompetence of the Johnson government. Really, this is something that should have been implemented much earlier. And it could have been very clear that, you know, this new variant had arrived and it was based in the southeast of London and numbers were growing fast, which you could read, which you could be aware of. And therefore, we had to move to a lockdown well before the date that was announced, allowing people to make plans for the holiday and not having to rip them up at the last minute or trying to scrabble onto a flight or a train or whatever to get out of London before midnight.
Yeah, the Labour leader called it gross negligence, and that the alarm bells had been ringing for some time, just to borrow a phrase from the Labour leader. Now, a lot has happened since. More than 40 countries have banned arrivals from the UK. There seems to be that this decision is taking on more and more, let's say, ramifications to it.
I think there's two things here. I think the decision to stop people coming in from the UK on flights, etc., I think that's understandable. although I do agree with what was said by, in the package, that the new variant is in continental Europe, but actually further away in Australia and elsewhere. I think the decision of France to shut the port, essentially access for the port of Dover to Europe, not allowing freight in, I think most people in Britain will see that as connected to the Brexit talks. And whether right or wrongly, they'll see that Emmanuel Macron, who's one of the hawks in the whole Brexit process, have implemented this, if you like, as revenge for the whole Brexit thing, whole Brexit vote. And therefore, I think it's going to lead, at a time when people are already upset about what's happened with the Christmas holidays, now we're hearing talk of food shortages, etc., it's only going to add to the anguish of what people here are feeling at a very sensitive moment. And it seems to me that France taking that decision really was very, very bad PR, at the least.
Right. We're expecting to hear from the British Prime Minister in the coming hour, I guess, and we'll see what he has to say about it all. But talking about Brexit now, do you think at this point a transition period being extended is inevitable?
I think Boris Johnson has a real problem with this because his own backbenchers, the Brexit backbenchers, are going to oppose that. As they report, they basically want a no deal because they fear that in this negotiations, they will have, the government will give ground over fishing and other things in particular. So among his Brexiteer backbenches, there will be bitter opposition to this. And many of these are the same people who oppose the imposition of the tier system over COVID, this current lockdown as well. So I think Johnson is caught as the champion of Brexit. The other factor which is breaking here is that there is a general sense, I think, that the United Kingdom is beginning to come apart. You know, when you discover the parallel negotiation over with Gibraltar over allowing the Schengen Agreement to be in place, a freedom of labour, yes, Gibraltar is not part of the UK, but it's no UK overseas territory. Then we've had this deal in the island of Ireland, which seems to be allowing free trade across the border without any restrictions, and the situation in Scotland, which you might come on to, with the Scottish government arguing that there should be this deal. There is a sense that the United Kingdom is really beginning to edge apart here. And I think Johnson must be aware he doesn't want that as his political legacy, the man who broke up the United Kingdom.
It's only a matter of time, I think. We'll see how things will transpire as we move forward in the coming months. Thank you very much, Chris Bambury, author and commentator. Thanks for joining the program. And now let's have a look at some other news this hour. Two men have been found guilty of the manslaughter of 39 men, women, and children from Vietnam after they were found dead in the back of a truck near London last year. The refugees, aged 15 to 44, were sealed inside for at least 12 hours in temperatures that rose above 38 degrees Celsius. The two drivers, 24-year-old Amon Harrison and 43-year-old Jorge Nica, were found guilty of 39 counts of manslaughter and one count of assisting in unlawful immigration in a case which shone light on the perilous journeys undertaken by refugees to reach European shores. At least 10 people have died following the outbreak of a fire inside a hospital's intensive care unit in Turkey. State-run news agency Anadolu News says the fire started when an oxygen cylinder exploded inside a unit for COVID-19 patients. The victims are reportedly aged between 56 and 85. The country's health minister said he was deeply saddened by the tragedy and that an investigation was underway. Five people have been injured following the collapse of a residential building in the Portuguese capital, Lisbon. The building collapsed after a fire started inside it. The five injured were whisked off to a nearby hospital as firefighters battled the flames. The local fire department has said two people were still unaccounted for. The cause of the fire is yet to be known.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
And in this segment, a massive drug bust in Italy, with Italian police claiming the 14 tons of Captagon originated from Syria and were destined for Libya. Well, let's bring in Ahmed Caballo to break it down for us. Ahmed, tell us why you picked this story.
It's a fascinating report by the BBC. They make some very big allegations about Captagon, which is an amphetamine drug that's used to increase alertness, boost concentration, and boost confidence on the battlefield. Now, they claim that the Syrian government and Hezbollah are responsible for distributing billions of pounds worth of this drug.
This is not the first time, Ahmed, a report like that is made. Any evidence presented by the, of course, the reporter there?
No evidence at all. So the report is short. It's about 2 minutes 30. I'd advise our viewers to go on the BBC website to check it out. He makes these big claims. He gives no evidence. In fact, the logic for his argument is because it comes from quote-unquote Syrian-controlled or Syrian government-controlled areas, that it means that Syrian government is involved, as well as its allies, the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. But that argument makes no sense. That's like saying if drugs are found in London, which is British government-controlled areas, that means the British government is involved. So it doesn't make any sense. And what's worrying is the BBC raises its flag of being impartial in all of its output, yet it's failed on its impartiality with this report. Now, we've got a tweet from Children of the Dust. He says, BS, nothing in this video proves that the substance is meth or that Assad is associated with it. Syria is not America's problem. CIA, degenerate. Now, we've got another video from John Stockwell. He's a former CIA operations officer. He explains how journalists work with intelligence communities and what they do to disseminate propaganda.
Another thing is to disseminate propaganda to influence people's minds, and this is a major function of the CIA. And unfortunately, of course, it overlaps into the gathering of information. You have contact with a journalist, you will give him true stories, you'll get information from him, you'll also give him false stories.
Straight from the horse's mouth goes the expression, Ahmed.
Yeah, and this is an interesting report, because if you watch the report, the BBC reporter, Quinton Somerville, he's given exclusive access. He even holds the drug, which is allegedly evidence, and he's playing around with it, and then he's there when the drugs are destroyed. And you wonder, why is he given such access? Possibly because the Italian government, the European Union, and Western governments are working hand in glove with organizations like the BBC to paint a certain image of the Syrian government, of the Islamic Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. Now, final tweet on this, Lee Camp from Redacted says this: the war on drugs achieves domestically what the war on terror has achieved internationally. Under the guise of dealing with the problem, the US government can arrest and kill hundreds of thousands in order to control populations that pose an issue for the empire. And what we've seen with Syria is it's been demonized in the war on terror, but it has that propaganda hasn't worked. Most people recognize that the Syrian government has been fighting terrorists in Syria, and now they've changed their propaganda operation, and now they're trying to make them seem as some sort of drug dealing cartel. Yet they're making these allegations without any evidence, and that's why people online are not buying it.
Okay, let's move on to your second story. The U.S. Congress voting $4 billion of American taxpayer money in aid to Israel in 2021.
Yeah, so this is an interesting story because it was part of the United States Congress approving a national defense bill, which was $740 billion worth of U.S. military budget. Now, what's interesting about this story is it got bipartisan approval. There wasn't a big deal made of it in the press. At the same time, the COVID relief bill to give Americans relief during a health pandemic was debated on in the Congress and was left down to the wire before it was passed. And when it was passed, they agreed to give Americans $600, that's right, $600 one-off payment, which is not even enough to pay their rent. And some are asking, why is it that American taxpayers can pay for the welfare of Israeli citizens, yet Americans have a health pandemic in which over 300,000 people have died, over 17 million people have been infected, there isn't the relief needed. Now, we've got a tweet from If Americans Know. It says, Congress votes $4 billion to aid to Israel in 2021. Press don't tell Americans about the massive aid to Israel, a tiny entity with a long record of human rights abuses, violations of law, systematic racism, and damage to Americans. Maria says, meanwhile, and then after this tweet, she plays a video of homeless people that we're going to play. Now, in this video, you can see, obviously, homeless people struggling in the United States. And this is coming at a time where Jimmy Dore, the American comedian, has tried to push progressives to push the Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, to pass a motion or to have a vote on Medicare for All. Now, the U.S. doesn't have universal health care, yet Israel does have universal health care. And some are asking, why are American taxpayers paying for American, for Israeli citizens to have benefits that are not even afforded to U.S. citizens?
That is a valid question, Ahmed, indeed, that question that people are asking. Ahmed Caballo with those stories for us. Ahmed, thanks as always. Let's have a look at some other stories now. Europeans are set to start getting coronavirus vaccines before the new year after the regional drug regulator accelerated its approval process following the launch of immunization campaigns in the U.S. and Britain. The European Medicines Agency has begun the evaluation process for the vaccine made by U.S. company Pfizer and German partner BioNTech. Germany, France, Italy, and five other European states will coordinate the start of their vaccination campaigns, with plans in place to incorporate the rest of the bloc as a second wave of the virus forces regional and national lockdowns over the festive period. Well, speaking of festive periods, Pope Francis has led his final Sunday address of the year at St. Peter's Square in the Vatican and touched on the celebration of Christmas in the modern age.
Consumismo, fratelli e sorelle.
Brothers and sisters, consumerism has kidnapped Christmas, taking it away from us. There is no consumerism in the manger in Bethlehem. What is there is reality, poverty, and love.
The pontiff also spoke about the evolving celebrations during the COVID pandemic and asked followers to visit the various nativity scenes around St. Peter's Square. Let's bring you two more social media stories that have been trending. Number one, troubling scenes captured by the body cam on a police sergeant in the U.S. city of Boston, showing him bragging about using his vehicle to hit people during the racial justice protests over the summer. Richard Sudan joins me now with all the details. Richard, what has changed since last time we heard about this?
So this is a quite incredible story, which I think is very revealing, and it captures an exchange between two Boston-based police officers. One officer is basically bragging about hitting with his patrol car Black Lives Matter protesters back in May.
He literally admits he used his vehicle to ram into the protesters.
He says, and I quote, "I was hitting people with the car," and he says it with a certain amount of enthusiasm and relish. And you can see, of course, the other officer walks away and realizes the whole thing has been recorded. As it stands, I think the officer has remained unidentified and has been placed on leave. But I think this video really gets right to the heart, Saeed, of why many people are calling for the police to be defunded. There's no getting around this. And of course, the added dynamic to this is the fact that this officer was running over protesters at a Black Lives Matter protest. It's hard to imagine other groups of people.
Let's hear the
really
online reaction to this, Richard.
Let's go to Mike, first of all, who says, this is why all law enforcement should have body cams. The fact the officer whose body cam picked it up turned immediately after the bad seed admitted to a crime is an example of the blue wall of silence he immediately knew and the face on the criminal cop. And Stephen says, cop brags about hitting protesters with his car and his fellow cops do absolutely nothing. They do worse than nothing. The one with the body cam walks away to cover for him.
All right, we're going to stay in the U.S. We'll move on to your second story. Donald Trump apparently entertaining more anti-democratic paths to preserving his power, although he denies it all.
incredible stuff. So a meeting which apparently took place on Friday has had White House staffers basically running to the press, apparently because Donald Trump floated and asked questions about the idea of introducing the army and martial law to undergo a second presidential rerun. Apparently Trump was encouraged by former disgraced advisor Michael Flynn, and apparently the chief of staff quickly rebutted the very question, the idea and the notion, but I think the very fact that Donald Trump would even consider talking about using martial law in a White House meeting is quite incredible, and I think it reminds
us... attorney, Rudy Giuliani, rather, tried to dissuade him from doing what he just said. So what have people been saying about this?
Let's go first to Duncan G on Twitter, who says, let's hope someone declares Trump mentally unfit before he declares martial law and becomes the dictator he wants to be. And YB also writes, even if Trump imposes martial law in the battleground states that cost Trump the election, the votes have already been certified. Biden won the election and there are no do-overs. Martial law doesn't amend the Constitution. At noon on the 21st of January, Biden is president by operation of law. Let's see how that process pans out.
Let's see, like you say. Richard Sedan with those stories. Richard, thank you. And that does it for this London broadcast, everyone.